Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In a sudden flash, it all comes clear. It's a eureka moment, an epiphany. Hi, I'm Marcus Smith, host of the Constant Wonder podcast. The world offers marvel, meaning, and mystery around every single corner. In nature, art, science, culture, history, we talk everything from bees and beetles to obelisks and asteroids. Experience the thrill of transformative encounter. We'll bring more wonder to your day.
Listen to Constant Wonder wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. Marcus, who have we got with us today? Because you are not Alina.
We've got Robbie McNiven showing us something quite different today. We're going back to the 1750s, the 1780s, and we're doing the British light infantry in the American Revolution and the Seven Years' War.
This is brilliant because, it's like you say, this is a patch of history that usually falls in the cracks with us.
Robbie's a Black Library author, if any of you are fellow geeks and like your Warhammer and Warhammer 40,000, but he's recently published a book on the British Light Infantry, and I found it, it's an Osprey, found it a really good read. Ooh, there we go, visuals. It's something that I keep coming back to because 9/5 rifles, sharp, and the British Light Infantry were invented down in Shorncliffe in the 1800s? Apparently not. So this is where we're going to be learning some stuff today.
Brilliant. So kick us off then. Where are we going to start?
So let's go start off with the American Revolution, if we can, Robbie. Was the British Army badly trained for fighting in that war?
That is a common misconception, and you can kind of see why it builds up over the years. But I think... Well, it is a misconception. I think that actually, in reality, the British armed forces are fairly well equipped when it kicks off in 1775 to deal, at least at a tactical level, with their colonial enemies. The most important thing to remember from this period is that the British are not strangers to fighting in North America. You know, the Seven Years' War / French and Indian War in the mid-1700s sees them engaged across North America from Quebec to Florida. And the people involved in that sort of mid-level officers at that stage are coming back as, you know, major and lieutenant generals during the revolutionary period, taking the experience that they have from that style of warfare in North America and really inserting it into the expectations of what they're going to be dealing with when it comes to fighting. I don't know what you call them, the revolutionaries, the rebels. Patriots is kind of a bit of a dated term.
Naughty scamps. Let's go naughty scamps.
My PhD supervisor used to say that the difference between the American patriots, so-called, and the loyalist Americans was how they pronounced either patriot or patriot. So, it's a bit of a dated term. But anyway, we'll just go with revolutionaries for now.
Yeah. If the truth was here, he'd be go full on with traitor, wouldn't he, Marcus?
Oh, yeah, to the king. So before that, they're fighting the Native Americans, the indigenous people, and the French, which is, well, this is our last of the Mohicans territory, but either the book, which is very good, or, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis' film, Epic Music. Is that the origins of the British Light Infantry?
Just about, yes. Some people claim that... because before the Seven Years' War, you had British forces in the Highlands of Scotland, where I am, suppressing the Jacobite Rebellion of 1745. And there are some historians claim that the origin of the idea of light infantry comes from that period, where you would need sort of less cumbersome units that were able to patrol the Highlands, which at that period were kind of a colonial frontier in their own sense. The Seven Years' War is really where you see the emergence of a regular light infantry formations in the British Army. You see some of it in Europe, actually, so it's not just an American experiment. You have all sorts of European developments with Frederick the Great creates Jaegers, sort of the Prussian light infantry. You have The Russians utilize Cossacks. The Austrians have Grenzers. So this concept of light infantry, these sort of more independent-minded troops that can be used to skirmish and harass against the enemy, that exists in Europe. And the British do learn from that to an extent because they are fighting in Europe alongside the Prussians. But it really is in North America where the terrain is more hostile, where they learn basically off the colonists, so people like Robert Rogers, Rogers Rangers, and off their enemies, so the Canadian, French, and Native Americans who are masters of this sort of thing. And British realize they have to utilize the same tactics if they're going to go toe-to-toe with them, and they do pretty effectively.
Can I ask you, before we get into the sort of deep dive on the subject with you, just for listeners that aren't au fait with this period and what we're talking about, what is the difference between normal infantry and light infantry? Why are they being labelled differently? And like you said, it's all down to carrying less cumbersome equipment, but what are the differences between the two?
That's a good question. I mean, it's kind of interesting because later on you can maybe get into the fact that it's a bit of a blurred line. So tactically, light infantry would be expected to skirmish. So basically, they, in a period where warfare is two lines, you know, having at each other, light infantry are going to be moving around in looser formations, kind of acting independently. They're ideal for fighting in woodlands and stuff. So that's, you know, it's useful in North America. There's a few sort of particular distinctions. So light infantry are, on paper, they're expected to be quite short, which is kind of the opposite of their brother company in the regular regiments, which is the Grenadiers, who are expected to be over 6 foot. So light infantry are drawn from the shorter men. They're supposed to be excellent marksmen, so the best shots. They're supposed to have a sort of an independent streak because obviously militaries in this period are quite heavily regulated by their officers. But light infantry have to operate out with normal command structures if they're sort of off in the woods gallivanting. So the men are expected to be able to act sort of independently. And they have to have really good stamina because they have some crazy, ridiculous sort of marches to catch the enemy unawares, laying ambushes and all that sort of stuff. I think one light infantry officer in a revolution mentioned that his unit marched 60 miles in 24 hours. Which I thought would be barely humanly possible, but I'm informed by a very fit friend that actually that is possible. But yeah, it's so yeah, they have to have good stamina. So overall, kind
long
of
long way with your back.
It's not possible, but definitely not desirable.
Absolutely not. I couldn't do it, but apparently they could. So yeah.
No Gore-Tex boots and North Face gilets. They're just. But is this where we start to see the emergence of what I term modern time pairs fire maneuver? But we see them operating in twos. Do we see them lying down, which is radical? I'm thinking again, Last of the Mohicans. You've got the line standing there firing into the ambushes, and they miss. And then you've got Sharp and Waterloo. They're all standing in line. Apart from our favourite Richard Sharp, who runs forwards in the 95th. Of course, but everyone else is kind of standing around. So are we seeing them now develop into some sort of independent tactics?
Yeah, absolutely. There is fire and mover, sort of the double pairs, one fires, one reloads. I sadly haven't got the instructions for that to hand, but it's interesting seeing how they would spell it out. One officer said that if you're in the light infantry, it might all come down to the importance of a single well-placed shot, which is dramatic, but true, I suppose. There is kind of this misconception, especially with the American Revolution, that the British, they're all very proper and they march into battle with wonderful uniforms and in neat rows, and they can't possibly deal with the sniping, crafty Americans who are too clever. But that's not true at all. The actual reality is that the British knew what this type of warfare was like from the Seven Years' War, and modified really their entire tactical doctrine in order to help deal with this idea of irregular warfare, where you would not stand in lines and you would fire and maneuver, as you said.
Because this is not my period at all, so am I understanding it correctly then that the reason we're looking at the evolution of the light infantry, is this down to adapting to fighting in like a vast arena in America and inhospitable, and sort of just, it's the back end of nowhere at this time, isn't it?
Pretty much. There's sort of a coda has to be added to that a little bit, because in the Seven Years' War, it's a conflict between the British held colonies and the French held colonies. And that conflict therefore takes place on the frontier wilderness, because, you know, that's the space in between them. So that's naturally where they end up fighting. In the Revolution, it occurs more in the heartlands of the actual colonies. Obviously, it's an uprising throughout the colonies. So you do have fighting in sort of more settled areas. If you look at the first battle of the war, Lexington and Concord, they're basically having a running street fight through various towns and villages, going out to Lexington and then back to Boston, where, you know, there's loads of buildings along that route. But generally, yes, there's a lot of wilderness. It's not settled. It's a lot of sort of woodland, forest, mountains, and that sort of environment is not ideal for regular form tactics, but that's why you have a light infantry.
So going off that, equipment. So are they adapting their equipment to fight in this territory? And especially, I really want to know about rifles, obviously. But there's something that's been read a lot recently is the 95th Rifles are the first ones to be armed with Baker rifles. And I often read, no, that's not true. You know, the 60th Rifles are the first British Army unit to be armed with rifles. But I was reading about Ferguson and a few others. So is that not quite the full picture? Are some of them, because you mentioned a single well-placed shot. Is that that we're getting, you know, rather than a smooth barrel, which I always think of as a bit of like a tennis ball out of a drain pipe, a rifle puts a spin on the bullet, yep, a little quarter turn, a bit like the opening scene of James Bond. You see those grooves, and you can actually shoot where you're going. Is that, are we seeing some of those in North America in the 1700s?
Yes, absolutely. So the interesting thing about this conflict is it sees the first ever development of a standard issue British rifle for the British Army. So you mentioned Ferguson, Patrick Ferguson, Scott, who ends up commanding a unit of American loyalists, and he's a bit of an inventor, and he invents a repeating rifle. So it's doesn't involve a ramrod. You load it at the base of the breech, and that obviously would increase the rapidity of fire exponentially. It does have flaws in so much as the breech is not particularly well sealed, so it's prone to jamming and clogging and all sorts of stuff like that, which means that ultimately it's a bit of a failed experiment, but he equips his 100 loyalists with that weapon. It's kind of a bit of a bugbear because a lot of people talk about the Ferguson rifle because it is really interesting. You know, it's a clever invention. It's about 100 years before its time, more or less. But it doesn't really have much of an impact on the war because, as I said, it's about 100 soldiers get equipped with it, and they only use it for a couple of years, I think, because it doesn't really stand up to the rigors of hard campaigning. But the 1776 pattern British Army rifle is specifically ordered by the government in 1776 because they realize what's going on in America and how Americans have access to a lot of rifles. So they order 1,000 of these to be produced. It's based on a German design. And these rifles are then disseminated, 5 to every light infantry company and 5 to every squadron of light dragoons. So every British regiment now has the capacity to match American riflemen in combat, which, again,
it's changing things quite a bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's quite a technological, like, leap forwards.
Yeah. And I like to argue, you know, I think more research needs to be done. But, you know, this idea that, oh, the Americans have rifles, the revolutionaries have rifles, and, you know, they were far superior to the smoothbore muskets. I think it's possible when you take into account that there were American loyalists and also most of the Native Americans sided with the British. In reality, the pro-British government forces of the revolution had more rifles than the revolutionaries.
That's really different. That's the opposite to what we see in that terrible film, The Patriot.
I knew that was going to come up. Horror.
Championed by one of our Down the Pub regulars as the best film ever made as a joke, and I still haven't forgiven him.
But it still didn't come last. Poor Despot.
I like to think that everything I've done for the past decade has been an attempt to refute just The Patriot.
I've got a new phrase. It's called de-Gibsonizing history. I used it in something the other day because I was talking about it wasn't the Patriot dude and it wasn't Braveheart. It was Gallipoli. And I said, like, certain aspects of history now need de-Gibsonizing, and that is definitely one of them. You know, you're saying that, so this is, the British are very used to standing in lines. Like, I'm thinking of a much better film in Last of the Mohicans. So the standing in lines, which always baffled me when I was a kid, like, why do they just stand there and wait to get shot? But that's what the British are used to, and that's what the British have been taking all over the planet. So do they fail at irregular warfare? Is it so alien to them that they're rubbish at it?
Only occasionally. Normally they deal with it pretty well. So... again, because of the Seven Years' War, they realise things are not going well. Last of the Mohicans, you know, you see the famous ambush scene where they get jumped by all the Native Americans. That sort of thing isn't really happening by the time of the revolution, that's for sure. The whole concept of the fighting in lines thing, it's not just a British thing. It's just sort of tactically how the technological era caused armies to fight. And it's interesting because a lot of modern historians are actually saying that the American Revolution wasn't won by the revolutionaries.
It's going to go down well on that side of the pond.
Yeah, it wasn't run by the revolutionaries because they were good at guerrilla warfare and the British were bad. It was actually won by the revolutionaries because the Continental Army became really good at regular fighting. So at the start of the war, the Continental Army, when they go toe-to-toe with the British in formed lines, get pasted. But over the years, they slowly improve, they become more disciplined, they become more experienced, and by the end, they can fight British regulars in lines, toe-to-toe, and 50% of the time, they'll win. So I don't think that actually the whole, you know, standing in lines and getting shot at is really an issue for the British, because they do adapt. They have, apart from light infantry, they have all sorts of Native American allies who, again, are used to this kind of warfare. Loyalist Americans, who also fights, can fight in this irregular style. I think it's just been overplayed by history because it's kind of like a cool thing. And there's also interesting that a lot of the idea about how the revolutionaries win through guerrilla warfare comes about from the 1960s and 70s when Vietnam was going on. Mm-hmm. There's a theory that American historians of that period were looking at Vietnam and saying, oh, well, actually, this must have precedent, you know, this is really working very well against us. This must have been what we did back in 1775, whereas in reality, it's only a part of the picture.
How does this change things? Like, so we do actually get pitch battles. We do actually not, so you've got these guys going out ranging, skirmishing, ambushing, but the Americans form up a Continental Army, a proper force, I believe blue coats, white facings, and they march onto the battlefield. How do the light infantry tactics impact actually when they're coming to stand next to each other? I'm thinking of battles like Brandywine. Talk us through what the light infantry do there, if you could.
So the Continental Army is basically formed because the revolutionaries realise that they need legitimacy. You know, if they want to be an independent country, an independent country has a standing army, even if it's a small one. So they decide they have to have a force that can actually sort of represent the regular armed forces, obviously led by George Washington, and they engaged the British in fairly numerous battles, and without trying to sound biased, they lose a lot of them. They love to try. But yeah, Brandywine is one of the major engagements between Washington and General Howe in command of the British, and Howe is a poor strategist but a good tactician, and at Brandywine he pins Washington's attention with a smaller force, and then flanks round to the sides and kind of delivers a hammer blow from the opposite direction. And that flanking movement is led by the light infantry, who are normally the vanguard for these sorts of things. They're out front. It does help to highlight their skills as skirmishers, because the terrain they end up fighting through is pretty sort of disjointed. There's lots of trees and gullies and rocks, and they end up engaging continental line units and kind of the reverse of this popular image of the British in rows and the Americans skirmishing. The Continental Army in that fight are in ranks, all lined up, and the light infantry are operating sort of in little pockets, little groups running around, engaging where they have to, pulling back where they have to, displaying the sort of independence that makes them effective troops, because they don't operate, they're in battalions, so it's, you know, 10 companies of light infantry, but they don't fight as a single block. Their companies are allowed to kind of go off on their own initiative, depending on how things are going and the sort of terrain they're fighting in. So they engage this Continental Army line sort of very fluidly rather than just going toe-to-toe, and they end up more or less decimating them and winning the battle.
I heard an anecdote, and you can tell me if it's true, that at this battle, we mentioned Major Ferguson earlier with his breech-loading rifles, and his men spot at least one officer in a flamboyant uniform and ask for permission to open fire and basically snipe, using a more modern term, and pick off the enemy officers. And Ferguson apparently says no, it's not very gentlemanly, and that could have been George Washington. Is that, you know, that would have been not only battle-changing, that would have changed the course of history. So is there truth in that?
Oof, to be honest, I couldn't tell you. It does sound like one of those lovely apocryphal little stories. It kind of like, I don't know, it kind of annoys me when you hear stories like that, because it promotes this idea that in the 18th century, everyone's all very like, oh, you know, it's all about honor, and yeah, you couldn't possibly do something that would actually then win us the battle or the war if it's dishonorable, which isn't always the case. You know, fighting in the 18th century is nasty. But it could be true. Ferguson was famously extremely honorable. Yeah, could have changed everything there, but that's what happens. I think there's a story of, it could actually have been Brandywine, I think it was Germantown, where General Howe, the British commander, has a pet dog, a little dog, I can't remember the species, but he gets lost during the battle, and the revolutionaries actually capture the dog, and they realize whose dog it is, and George Washington sends it back with a note saying, sorry for capturing your dog, here it is.
I thought you were going to say they killed the dog, and I was like, it's one thing to turn traitor against the king.
It sounds like the kind of propaganda just invented to make him sound great, like, oh, it's nice to puppies. As a non-dog person, I'm completely unmoved by that story.
Alex Scott, no, bastard. Yeah. We were talking about honour. Brandywine's one battle that the British absolutely trounced the colonial army, don't they? And then we've got, correct my pronunciation here, Powley. Correct. And this is completely different. This is where the light infantry are going in at night with bayonets, with knives, and they come across the Americans and, well, what do they do, basically? Why is this so different?
Yes, that's interesting, because it's sort of the idea, if it was modern day, we'd sort of call it special operations or something like that. You know, it's a nighttime raid over a fairly long distance where they don't actually catch the Americans completely by surprise. They get some warning beforehand, but they're very much unprepared. And it's the sort of thing where, you know, if you're going in and attacking an enemy who's sort of unprepared and it's dark and it's all a bit confusing, that's the sort of situation where prisoners don't often get taken, because it's all a bit chaotic and you worry that if you start taking prisoners, then, you know, they might try and escape or they might turn on you amidst the chaos. So it's one of several incidents where British forces sort of commit potentially an atrocity. They try and play it up, that is, the revolutionaries try and play it up as a massacre afterwards, whereas the British say it's just of an effective military operation, you know, it was, there's nothing particularly unusual about it. And to be honest, I don't think it's particularly unusual during the period, you know, that sort of thing happens, not regularly, but it's not unknown. It's a case of, well, actually the soldiers, the British light infantry attacked without flints in their muskets because they didn't want any stray shots to give away their approach. So they had to use their bayonets, didn't have any other weapons. And that's where it started to get messy. So
that's what I was reading. So they're going forwards at nighttime through mostly through woods. And if anyone's ever tried to walk through woods at nighttime, it is impossible to stay silent. I remember moving with a section of just 8 men, and it sounds like a herd of huge elephants, like walking through any trees. It is really difficult. And then they're going in with bayonets. So this is kind of, you're probably not going to be doing this with your regular line infantry. They're going to be stomping around, especially if they were marching in line. They're just like walking to trees and down ditches. So this is a little bit, like you say, a little bit special. This is picking out these men with, they might be shorter, but they might be more intelligent. They might be swift, and they might have this extra training. And they're going in and they're doing something a bit underhand, or maybe it's not so underhand, you were saying. We just like to think that everyone was very honourable, really stiff upper lip, and we're going to wait until 11 o'clock to start fighting. But actually, if the opportunity's there, the light infantry are the ones going to be taking this opportunity?
Yeah, definitely. And it's the sort of thing that actually happens on multiple occasions. So a year later, there's what becomes known as the Baylor incident or the Baylor massacre, where, again, the light infantry do a forced night march and they come upon about six barns that are occupied by Continental Army light dragoons who are asleep at the time, and they just go from barn to barn, killing them silently with their bayonets. So it's something that they come to excel at, and actually it's so effective that then the Continental Army tries to mimic it. So the Continentals create their own light infantry force. They kind of pull the same trick a year after that. So at Stony Point, they launch an attack. This is American or Continental Army light infantry, using only their bayonets, catch a British garrison at Stony Point by surprise and win probably the best colonial victory of the year. They're basically just mimicking what had been done to them over the past 2 years by the British.
It just reminds me of the bit in Blackadder with the spies, and Blackadder goes forth. We're doing it. We're like heroic, noble soldiers, and then they start doing it to us. It's like underhand. How dare they?
It's true, yeah. I mean, there's really interesting how much the revolutionary side wins the propaganda war throughout the whole revolution. You know, if they do something nasty, then it gets covered up, or it's just, you know, it's in the name of liberty and freedom. Whereas whenever something bad is done to them by opposing forces, it's really played up. I mean, the Baylor incident that I talked about, they commission an investigation into it, and they have people giving testimonies and witnesses talking about how many wounds each individual soldier suffered. You know, some of them are sort of 17, 18, 19 wounds, and it's all sort of forensically displayed. Again, it's a form of propaganda, but it's extremely effective.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Is the biggest example of that, and I could just be completely Gibsonizing myself here, the church that they torch in that film?
Yeah, the famous church scene. So that is totally made up. There were a couple of churches burned by British forces in the south during the revolution, but there was no one in them at the time.
I heard that there actually were some American patriots, rebels, and they burned a church down with people in it, and they just reversed it. But
maybe. I could imagine them doing that. I mean, there were some horrific massacres against Native Americans by revolutionary forces. There was one where revolutionary militia just rounded up. It was actually a neutral tribe, so they weren't even aligned with the British, but they just rounded up this tribe of about 100 people, put them in a barn, and then started killing them one by one, like everyone, men, women, and children. And a couple of kids managed to escape, which is how it became known. But yeah, that was just insane. But that sort of stuff happened a lot on the frontier, where it gets even more complex because you have the Native American dynamic as not just sort of British versus revolutionaries, it's a whole sort of messy thing. But yeah, there was no mass church burning with people inside by the British, I'm glad to say.
Earlier on, we were talking about sneaking through the woods and these kind of pairs, and also operating at night. So something, when I think of the British uniforms at the time, you've got either mostly a tricorn hat, you've got big hats. The coats have actually got tails on them, a bit like a gentleman's morning suit, a Royal Ascot. You've got a lot of bags and coats and water bottles and bread bags. Do they adapt any of this for the light infantry?
Yeah, and then, I mean, the adaptions are so successful that they end up actually employing those changes throughout the army quite frequently. So the skirts that you mentioned on the coats are often reduced or cut down. Sometimes they even just take the waistcoat that they would have underneath the jacket and sew sleeves, because it's the same waistcoat. They just sew sleeves onto that and wear that as the coat, rather than the more cumbersome, heavy version. Hats get sort of changed. So Burgoyne's expedition in 1777, they do away with the tricorn and just have sort of less wide brims, felt or leather hats. Officers start doing away with the more extravagant symbols of rank. So they remove gorgets, for example, and they wear less fancy lace. And it's notably effective because I think one of the first battles of the war, Bunker Hill, the officers suffer disproportionately a huge number of casualties. But that's never really repeated. It's another sort of common trope that, oh, the Americans sniped British officers, and because they did that, because they were so cunning and clever, and the British didn't know what to do. I don't think actually statistically the British didn't suffer any higher officer casualties than any other conflict during this period, except for that initial fight at Bunker Hill, where afterwards they start removing these symbols of rank that mark them out. So they're being practical about it and they're introducing these changes.
So they get rid of some of these extra bits that mark them out as officers. They kind of look a little bit more like they're men. Do any of them carry muskets? Do any of them, because we always think a British officer is waving with his sword from a distance going, shoot over that way.
Yeah.
Apart from going back to our favourite friend, Richard Sharp, who's the only one, according to Bernard Cornwell, that's not the case in the peninsula. But I'm going back and I'm like, I've still got this preconception that in the 1700s, the officers are all gentlemen. Okay, the men are sneaking in and bayoneting people at night, so maybe they're not honourable gentlemen. But are they joining in? Are they firing? Are they protecting themselves with muskets?
Yeah. Well, speaking of maybe not honourable gentlemen, one of the incident I mentioned earlier, the Baylor Massacre, the revolutionary eyewitnesses that survived say that actually the light infantry, when they took prisoners, the regular enlisted men were saying to the officers, we've got these prisoners, what should we do with them? And the officers are the ones saying, kill them. So that's an interesting twist. But yes, British light infantry officers were armed with firearms. They were armed with fusils, which is basically, first off, they're a private weapon. So the officer buys his own fusil. He's not sort of issued it. It's not a mass market type weapon. And normally,
okay, if I'm going to join the light infantry, I need to go into London and buy myself a musket.
Exactly. Okay. So, they tend to be a bit lighter than a regular musket, but there's a common misconception they're shorter, which they're not always. So that lets an officer basically join in the fighting. There's some complaints in so much as people say, well, an officer shouldn't be fighting, he should be leading. You know, he should be, instead of thinking about loading and taking aim and all that sort of stuff, he should be thinking about the actual wider battle. But I think with light infantry, because of their role as skirmishers and being scattered as they are often in woodland and stuff like that, it's a good idea for an officer to have a firearm. So yeah, they would all be equipped with one.
So we've got specialist hats, specialist coats. We've got officers with firearms fighting. Do we see any of them wearing green? Bit of camouflage, bit of 95th jacket. Do we see this emergence of some sort of blending into their surroundings?
So interestingly, we see that in the Seven Years' War, one of the light infantry units raised swap their red coats for brown. So everything they have is brown. And they even brown their muskets and change their buttons to black so they don't shine.
Nothing shiny. Yes.
Nothing shiny. In the Revolution, so the Loyalist Americans, their standard uniform is actually green. So Simcoe and Tarleton and all his men, Loyalist officers, they all wear green. The British, off the top of my head, I don't think they have any units that wear green in the regular army, but there is, I think it's generally understood, especially when it comes to fighting like Canada and stuff, that it makes sense to not wear red.
We always see them in those highly like shiny red coats and that, but the reality is very different, isn't it? By the time they wore them everywhere in that.
Oh, absolutely.
More a faded pink colour.
Yeah, definitely. I hate seeing in films and stuff where they all have like pristine uniforms and like powdered hair and all that sort of stuff. Whereas in reality, I mean, I was reading just last week that one light infantry officer did not take his clothes off for 10 weeks because he was like, the campaign he was on was so intensive. Like, he didn't even, you know, change his shirt. He was wearing his clothes, like sleeping in them. He said he had his fusil with him constantly because they were constantly under the threat of being attacked. So yeah, I think the reality of 18th century uniforms is they were pretty grimy and a bit threadbare.
I mean, this is before Lynx Africa's invented. Yeah. So 10 weeks, he is gonna.
Just drowning yourself in an entire can of Lynx Africa in the morning wasn't going on in the American Revolution.
This is groundbreaking research.
Yeah.
You are going to smell that man for quite a way.
Yep, it's between the actual bad, like BO, and people's terrible teeth. I think those are the two main things that people don't appreciate about the past. If you went back in time, lots of nasty teeth and lots of bad smells.
Is it Nelson and the Agamemnon? There's that legend that that ship came back in once, and that you could smell it on the other side while it was still on the other side of the Isle of Wight.
That's amazing. I can imagine.
Nelson, you haven't just got one man smelling. You've got something like 500 men working together.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Thinking. No toothpaste. Yeah, it's going to be horrendous, the thought of it. And I mean, from what I believe of the 1800s, they were issued normally two shirts, two trousers, one jacket, and that lasts them until next year's supply. So you've got 12 months to wear the same jacket. It's going to, they say they're not going to be pristine looking like toy soldiers. They're going to have holes in the sleeves and probably missing another elbow. And it's just going to look really raggedy by the time they get back, especially if they're going through. In North America, it's full of really thick forest with thorns and brambles, and it's going to get torn. It's going to get ripped. It's wood, isn't it? It's not built to last.
Yeah. They were definitely a raggedy bunch. I mean, you see it a lot with art depictions of the Continentals. Often show them sort of threadbare and Valley Forge, no shoes, all that sort of stuff, because I think they like to play up the underdog idea. But the British were just the same with supply problems. And yeah, they would look nothing like the parade standard that we'd normally see. People don't realize that when you see portraits of officers from this period, it's a portrait. It's designed to show the officer looking at his best in his best uniform. Whereas in reality, you know, that's not how they would look in the field.
I know we're going to wind you up and let you go in a minute on our favourite subject, which is how shit Mel Gibson is. But before we do that, I know Marcus wants to know about the impact. What is the sum total of the impact for his period? So we've looked at your period, and we know that by his period, you've got Richard Sharp and you've got the 95th and that. But how do we get from one to the other?
Yeah, so the army actually forgets a lot of its lessons from the revolution. There's a faction, there's a bit of a war within the British High Command after the revolution ends. There's this fear that the fighting style of America with the skirmishing and the loose order and people kind of acting independently would not work in Europe against an army that was, you know, well-disciplined and formed up. So that if they then ended up at war with France, as they do, it would be better to mimic the Prussian style of fighting, which is very much the sort of regimented, everyone's in a line idea. So ultimately, the Prussian faction, if you will, won the battle for the heart and soul of the army in the decade after the revolution. But the lessons for the light infantry specifically aren't completely forgotten. So you have Sir John Moore, of course, who was an officer during the revolution and fought in the revolution, a very junior officer. He took lessons he'd learned from the style of fighting in America, and you get Shorncliffe and all that sort of stuff. Other units like the 60th, the Royal Americans become a rifle-only unit. I think the realization of how effective the rifle was down a lot to the fighting in America. I mean, Napoleon famously, this is the rifle, and says it's not suitable as like a mass weapon. But the British have seen how effective it can be in North America, and that's why you get units like the 95th.
Yeah. I was just going to say, yes, Sir John Moore, he's famous for his burial poem, which we covered in one of the Sharps reunions. We finished off with a little reading from Ali with that poem, which is really nice. But he's famous, He makes Wellington look good by his retreat. But he's there as a junior officer. And do you think he learned from these? So when he became a senior officer, he was like, actually, those men, they did good. So what I want to do is go and get more of that and bring it back. And there's a gap, isn't there? Experimental Corps Riflemen's 1800. So we've got a gap of, what, 20 years? And there's a bit of knowledge loss. But do you think that's where he's taking the ideas? He's put them in his back pocket for a while and he's bringing them back out at Shorncliffe on the south coast?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's just the continuation from, in the Revolution, you have senior officers who were junior officers in the Seven Years' War, so previous to the Revolution, taking their experience into the Revolution. And then when you come to the Napoleonic period, you have senior officers who were junior officers in the Revolution. So it's sort of that learns experience that carries over from one conflict to the next. And even if on paper, the British Army didn't really seem to capitalize on what it had learned in America, individual officers like Moore did. And eventually that shines through when you have obviously a highly effective light infantry. I think it's a full division by the Peninsula War.
By the end of it, it's the full division of light infantry, light division, with the 60th Rifles interspersed, one company per brigade, if they could, throughout the army. So people are learning. And something that we hadn't actually covered was the makeup of the regiments. By this point, every regiment's got a light company. So a tenth of your strength can go and do this skirmishing thing, which is something as a Napoleonic historian and being extra geeky, we've already talked Warhammer, I do reenactment as well, super geeky. We've got 95th Rifles and 60th Rifles, but you've actually got light companies can go forwards. And so all of a sudden, by the time you reach Waterloo, you've got a screen of light infantry in front of anybody. Sharp, he's part of a light company in the South Essex Regiment. But they didn't actually have that until, you know, the Seven Years' War.
Yeah, it's interesting as well, because in the Peninsula you have, or at least by Waterloo, you have entire regiments of light infantry, don't you? So second light infantry regiment?
Yeah, 43rd, the 52nd, and the 1st, and then during that time they're converting people like the 68 Durhams, and they're converting more and more through the period. I think they just started to wake up and go, we need this. And it's very interesting, I always think, it didn't happen before. Why did they not see this? And it turns out they did, and then they just kind of, some people forgot about it.
Yeah, kind of. It's an interesting development with the entire battalions of light infantry, because they did that in the Revolution, but they went about it in a different way. So you had one company per battalion was light infantry company. And what they did was they drafted those companies, removed them from their parent regiments, and formed a composite battalion made up of the companies of loads of different regiments. And then they could conduct these special operations like Powley and be generally effective on the battlefield. That was a bit, it had a downside, because it obviously means you've taken those companies away from their parent regiment, so that regiment's a bit under strength and it doesn't have access to light infantry. So clearly when it comes to sort of the Peninsula, they've realized that, well, actually, instead of just harvesting the companies from different regiments, we should just form regiments of light infantry as a basis, and then they can operate effectively. So,
because taking away a company, there's 10 companies in a battalion. One was already grenadiers, you mentioned the tallest, the strongest men. So then they're converting one of their other 9 companies left. So they're losing potentially a tenth of their strength to go off and do these ranging, these skirmishing, these ambushes. So that would affect, the battalion commanders who might not like that.
Yes, exactly. I think that's the case. But they solved that problem, I guess, by the Napoleonic period, where they have their own regiments of light infantry.
It really gives different backgrounds to the Napoleonic and the Peninsula War and even the Revolutionary Wars, that we'd think that they're only fighting in line and they're breaking new ground by doing line free tactics, and Richard Sharp's the first person to go off ranging with his own weapon, and actually they're not even a full generation before. They are doing this in America.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's interesting to highlight that. I think you mentioned at the start that this isn't, especially in Britain, the revolution is not a particularly popular topic, maybe because we lost. But I think recently there has been a lot of interest in the British side of the revolution. It's not just sort of the American story now. I mean, American historians and authors as well are doing loads of really good good research into how the British fought the war and coming up with the fact that actually they went about it pretty effectively. The issues were far more strategic than they were tactical. And when you come down to the sort of battlefield level, you have this light infantry component basically playing the revolutionaries at their own game.
Yeah, I mean, you say we lost, but George Washington was a British officer. Slightly treacherous British officer. So in a way, we won and we lost all at the same time because it was one of our own. So we can take a win there.
Only our own city.
Right, okay. I'm going to let you do
what we're going to do here is something a bit unusual, but I think it could be quite fun.
Yeah, let's de-Gibsonize the American Revolution. Tell us what's wrong with the Patriot. Oh, there's a whole episode on Braveheart, so it's only fair that you get to rip it.
I mean, as a Scot, I would also do something on Braveheart, but I'll leave that one at the door. I mean, I could talk for hours about the Patriot, not in a good way. It's just the idea that, I mean, for a start, he's South Carolina, sort of like landed gentleman, and supposedly his slaves are all free people working his lands, and he's paying them. That just takes the piss out of actual American history.
Mm.
You know, this idea that he would somehow be this noble guy that is doesn't have slaves on his plantation. That's literally a plantation he has. And that's just that side of it. In terms of the actual military history, my God, you know, it's like sniping from behind trees and catching out these dumb Brits who just don't know how to fight in woodlands and are so easily outwitted. And, you know, it's good fairy tale stuff, but when they then compound it by doing things like the church burning scene. I've read that the actual church burning scene was meant to be in Saving Private Ryan, because the producer for The Patriot was the same producer on Saving Private Ryan. And they were going to have a scene in that where the SS burn a bunch of civilians in a church, which they did do historically, but they never got around to using that scene. So the producer was like, I'll just stick it in my next film.
So Mel Gibson, who famously seems to hate the British for whatever reason, has taken a scene written for the Waffen-SS,
yes,
where the Waffen-SS, yes, kill a load of civilians and writes it as British officers.
Exactly. Yeah, that's literally what happened.
Wow.
So that just...
And worse than that, he has a character based upon somebody I think that you and I talk about a bit. Do it. The only good thing about The Patriot is Jason Isaacs. He is just a delicious baddie. He overacts it, hams it up. It is fantastic.
Yeah.
But he's playing a fictional character that's basically Tarleton, this kind of brilliant cavalry commander.
Yeah.
You'd say he's one of the good guys almost.
Definitely. He's one of my history favorites. He was an exceptional cavalry commander, probably the best of either side during the war. He won a whole string of battles. He's most famous because he'd lost his one big battle at Cowpens, which is, again, the basis for a lot of the fighting in The Patriot. But overall, he was kind of just a really interesting guy. He was pretty young. He was very much a sort of go-getter. He was always gambling. He was into the ladies. He was kind of rakish. He actually, this is a fun fact, he was supposed to command in the peninsula ahead of Wellington. They were thinking about him, and then in the end they decided to take a punt on this fairly young officer from the 33rd instead. And Wellington gets the job, which, you know, is probably for the best because ain't no one going to beat Wellington. But at that point, Tarleton was, you know, in his 50s and a general, but I'm not sure he would have been well suited to fighting the French in Spain. But in America, when he's sort of hunting down revolutionary militia and stuff, he's a very effective
fighter. He's charging out swamps, isn't he, with cavalry and light infantry coming in?
Yeah. All sorts of shenanigans, but not, I should add, doing crazy, brutal stuff like burning churches full of civilians. His one battle that he is kind of infamous for, Waxhaws, which is called the Waxhaws Massacre, he actually is leading the charge. His horse gets shot and he ends up trapped beneath his horse. And by the time he gets out, it's all over because it's just a cavalry charge that just breaks the infantry line. And obviously a lot of people get killed because it's a cavalry charge that just broke the infantry line. But again, speaking of propaganda from the war, the revolutionaries use this and call it a massacre and say that he's massacred all these people. And it's effective because they get loads of new recruits throughout the southern colonies when that happens. So you can see why they've done it. But it's, yeah, this idea of him as a butcher is just totally invented.
So apart from Jason Isaacs acting, and I think we get a couple of very overused GIFs on social media from the film, is there anything good in The Patriot?
Well, the costumes and the uniforms are kind of good and bad. So if you want to say this is what your average British, your Continental Army soldier, or even civilian looked like during the Revolution, that's correct. But then they don't factor in the realities of campaigning. So as we've already said, they would have been muddy, threadbare, all that sort of stuff. So
Mel Gibson's like a perfect perm, doesn't he? It's like
yeah,
tight.
Exactly. Yeah, in terms of like the lace and like the colours and all that stuff, it's correct. Like it's actually pretty good. The costume department, in fact, clearly done a lot of research and got that correct. But then it doesn't sort of go the next step and make it accurate, like properly accurate in terms of what it would have looked like. So I guess, you know, you can't really fault the film too much for that sort of stuff. So yeah, The Patriot, I will give it a small tick for costumes.
Costume development.
That's about it.
Brilliant. Robbie, thank you so much for coming on about the American Revolution and the development of light infantry. Plug your book for us.
So Osprey Publishing, British Light Infantry in the American Revolution. It's available on the Osprey website and Amazon and just online in general if you Google it.
Marcus, is it not available on our book page?
We are going to have it. Bernie's going to have it on our book page. So if anyone goes through the History Hack bookshop, they'll be able to link straight through. I think it might even be our first Osprey in there. I got it on Saturday. Loads of really lovely illustrations. Photographs from American reenactors who are reenacting these regiments you haven't really heard of. And if you like hats, I mean, these hats, like there are things in here that ladies at Ascot, beware, gentlemen in the 1970s, they've got it. They know it. No, great book, strongly recommends as Osprey is always welcome on any History Buffs bookshelf.
Don't forget that we do exist on Patreon as History Hack and on Patreon as well, which is Podbean's own version. Elena and I have had massive fun doing this in 2020, but life's going to change quite a lot next year and we're going to actually have to go and earn a living, etc. If we want to keep up the regularity that we've been bringing you and the kind of guests that we've been bringing you and the workload, then we will need your help. So if you join, there's going to be incentives for joining on either of those platforms. We're revamping ourselves on both of them. So don't forget to go in. You can do as little as a dollar a month and it all goes towards keeping up History Hack as regular as we've been able to bring it to you this year.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org. where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hack history or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support and here's to your next great book.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.